Thank you, Victor, for that kind introduction, and thanks to RJ for inviting me to participate in the Philadelphia Society meeting. It's a real pleasure to be with you all. I see part of my remit here is to make an argument for an activist conservative agenda with respect to American economic life. So I'll try to do that in the short compass of these few minutes. And I want to begin with some principles. Now, it's my conviction that the movement from principles to policy is a long and tortured path, but I thought that I would throw out some important principles that at least inform my thinking. The first is Romans 13:1. Let every man be subject to governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. Governing is a necessity. There's a necessity for us to govern, and that there's a dignity in governance, in in the role of statesman. And so, to my mind, therefore, the Christian is never anti-government. The second principle, Romans 5:12, no one is exempt from sin and death. And that this principle, the awareness of the reality of original sin, it counsels caution in the exercise of governmental power and skepticism about the self-proclaimed selflessness of those who exercise power. I mean, to the Lord Acton aphorism, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Certainly this lies behind the conservative idea of limited government. But it also, the notion of original sin, it also makes us aware of a law of what I would call political entropy. That is to say that our inherent sinfulness will cause any system, however well designed, to begin to run down. An economy, however well designed and whatever good footings has been placed by policy, will eventually go in bad directions. And so original sin, not just limited government, but also an awareness that there are times when we will have to intervene and put things back on a sound footing. And then finally, Matthew 25, what you have done to the least of these, you have done to me. So a Christian approach to political economy must always acknowledge and see, not just acknowledge, but at the very least to see the losers in our system. I think one of the reasons we face a crisis in our country is that those of us in a position of leadership could barely even see the people who are the losers in our system. They became increasingly invisible. To a certain extent, the left creates its rainbow array of purported victims that distracts attention from many of the losers in our system, and then in our own tendency to champion the great successes of our free economy, we often only are singing hosannas to the creative class and not even seeing those who have been left behind. So with those, like I say, those are three principles that I think inform my thinking about economic life in our society. And it's a long way from those principles to specific policies. And I always find myself to be, I get exasperated by debates over things that aren't really principles, but that rather they're operational priorities. They're all things considered judgments. Like lower taxes are always better, or lower taxes are better. I think on the whole, yes, but that's not to me a principle. That's a sort of operational judgment, a generalization, an all things considered position. And so instead of going to these by and large judgments, I think it's more fruitful for our conversation if I speak more specifically about the specific problems that I see in our society and then offer some policy responses to them. That always gets people's lather up when I start making policy responses. And please take them in the proper spirit. They're meant to be provocations to get us thinking about how we ought to reorient conservative priorities in the 21st century. The first problem, and I think this is one in which I think conservatives can widely agree, we suffer from the curse of giganticism, and that gigantic entities, and we certainly are aware of the problem of governmental giganticism, and that's been a leitmotif for conservatives since the New Deal. But there's other problems of giganticism abroad, and these are newer problems of a giganticism that have emerged in my lifetime. One problem I would put under the, there's a kind of political giganticism, cultural giganticism, and economic giganticism. And in the political light, so again, it's not just the administrative state, there's something new, and it's the rise of what I would call the mega parastate. The Gates Foundation, Packard Foundation, Mark Zuckerberg donating hundreds of millions of dollars to activist organizations that perhaps had more influence on the laws and regulations concerning the 2020 election than any public entity, single public entity. This is a very worrisome trend in our society that if unchecked, by the end of the decade or into the 2030s, there may be more policy experts employed by these para-governmental mega foundations and the entities that they fund than are currently employed by any federal agency. So it's a para-government. If you think the administrative state is a problem, you wait until Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and the rest of them endow $100 billion, $200 billion foundations that will exercise tremendous influence over the future of the governance of our society. So, I propose a $100 million lifetime limit to the charitable deduction for any individual. I think we need to take very clear measures in our tax law to prevent the continued growth of these gigantic, supersized foundations. I think it's, any conservative should be able to get behind that sort of policy. And maybe it's not 100 million, maybe it needs to be 50 million. Maybe it needs to be 250 million. Maybe we need to say no more than 1 billion to any single entity or related entity. I don't know how we can structure it, but we need to put a cap on the capacity of the super wealthy in American society to translate that wealth into governmental power, which leaps over the political process. So, then cultural giganticism. We suffer from the problem of super dominant elite universities in America. There are, in my lifetime, when I was growing up in Baltimore, Maryland, prosperous sons of Baltimore gentry wanted to either go to Princeton or UVA, and where they went, where they wanted to go depended on where their father had gone to college. Today, the lock of just a dozen or so universities on prestige in our culture is really quite astounding. So I propose, and I've proposed this in the past, a significant tax on supersized endowments. 90% of endowment principal is aggregated in the 50 largest university endowments. So, you know, maybe on a per student basis, maybe 2 to 5% of principal of the endowment per year as a tax. And we can use that those resources to fund free community college education. I would submit to you that the 50 most elite universities in the United States are far more of a problem for the future of our society and the future of our culture than the community colleges. Community colleges where ordinary people are trying to get nursing degrees or certifications in order to go on to decent paying middle class jobs. Economic giganticism. We suffer from the over dominant mega corporations. The vast majority of computing power in the United States is controlled by three different companies. Amazon, of course, dominates internet commerce. We are at risk of Main Street being swallowed by these gigantic retail corporations, as well as other problems just that are always associated with over-concentration of wealth. So I would propose a progressive corporate income tax that I think we need to really take seriously, so that small to mid-sized companies are taxed at a much lower rate than gigantic companies. I think it's a way to protect Main Street against being swallowed by globalized corporations. And the banking system is another area of, I think, giganticism that's going to pose a problem. My prediction is by the end of the decade, we will be much more like Europe, where we'll have 6 to 10 gigantic banks that have 90% of all deposits as the middle sector of our banking system collapses in the coming years. This is not good for, and I don't think any conservative should want the financial system to be so heavily concentrated. It allows it to be more directly controlled by government, and I think that this is something that we need to think about how to. I don't have a policy proposal. I'm even more ignorant in areas of high finance than I am in other areas of economics. So the problem of giganticism. Second problem is what I would call frayed solidarity in our society. And that is that the frayed solidarity manifests in populism. Populism is quite simply the rebellion of the many against the few. And I think it's a sign that the middling American has lost trust in the elite who run our country. So I think there are lots of things we should think about here. One problem is, you know, deindustrialization or the loss of the outsourcing of jobs and so on and so forth. So I would propose a corporate tax that is, again, progressive, and that's pegged to revenue divided by employees, so that companies that have a larger number of employees pay a lower tax on each dollar in profit. And then, you know, I'm not an expert in this, but I think we need to take a look at our intellectual property law. We went through a huge revision of that law, a very fundamental revision in the 1990s, in order to promote the tech industry. I think we've got an over-concentration of talent, of creative talent in the tech industry, and it would be worth it to revise those laws to offer less protection to intellectual property. And this might drive more creative talent back into the productive process, where incremental improvements in productivity can be made. And then I also think Orrin Cass's policies that he's proposed in the past, such as a revitalization of private sector unions in order to, as well as using wage subsidies rather than minimum wage to try to create a base for income, and then also targeted ways to improve the bargaining power of labor in our society, as well as immigration restrictions and other things to do to increase the pricing power of a person selling their wages on an hourly basis. And then finally, family disintegration, I think, is a serious problem facing our country. There's obviously, this is not amenable to economic policy in the way some other areas are, but we do need to think creatively. I think the policies that are being proposed in the Senate on paid family leave need close examination and trying to figure out how to design those benefits so that they don't only benefit women who work, but also women who stay at home and take care of their children. But I think you get less of what you tax, you get more of what you subsidize. And if we want women to invest in their children at the time when their care is the most valuable in those first year or two of the infant's life, then we need to create incentives We need to reward that financially in our society. We need to think creatively about how to do that. And also things like deregulating the environment for housing construction and so forth. There's no doubt that the historically high costs of housing plays a large role in discouraging family formation in the United States. Well, I could go on and on. Actually, I couldn't because, like I say, I'm not an expert in this field, and I wanted to throw out provocative policy suggestions. And I want to conclude by making some observations about why this kind of thinking is needed. 2023 is not 1980. In 1980, peak baby boomers were reaching their early 30s. These men and women had tremendous social capital behind them, having grown up in a time period of unprecedented solidarity in our society with a middle-class consensus that really encouraged the middle-class virtues. And so that generation, having followed the stagnant decade of the 1970s, to deregulate and to create tax incentives for creative activity was absolutely the right policy, and it paid handsome dividends. We are an over-consolidated country that had a lot of creative potential in the baby boomer generation. This is not the case today. We live in a disintegrated country, a deconsolidated and disintegrated country. As I think Matthew Schmitz noted, 40% of children are now born out of wedlock. 100,000 people die a year of drug overdose death. It is, I think, not realistic to assume that all we need to do is lift the shackles of whatever aspect of government in our society and that something great and creative will emerge in its place. Instead, we need to think about how we can renew and reconsolidate our country and how we can renew the American middle class. And finally, I think when we engage that, we have to think about the moment we live in. It's a different moment. It's a moment that, as I say, is going to require leadership to try to renew and reconsolidate the country. But also, I think we need to, in conclusion, we need to always keep in mind this law of political and economic entropy. There's a tendency on American right to fix on the law of unintended consequences, which of course is true, that if we follow through on my progressive corporate tax, that will create all kinds of incentives we can't anticipate that may have lots of negative consequences. But one thing I learned from reading Blaise Pascal is that the rationale for or the reasonableness of a certain course of action depends upon the urgency of the situation. If you come to a bridge, a rickety bridge across a deep chasm, a rickety footbridge across a deep chasm, that has a possibility of giving away when you cross it, only a fool would put a step forward onto that rickety bridge. But if you're being chased by brigands who are going to kill you if you don't get away, only a fool would fail to cross that rickety bridge. I believe that our country is in bad shape and that we are being chased by brigands and that therefore we need to take risks of governance and cross the rickety bridge to get us to a better future for our society and for our fellow citizens. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rusty, for those provocative comments. I now join me in welcoming to the platform Dr. Samuel Gregg.